From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. For generations, Americans have rallied around the claim that we're number one. And for generations, the claim has in many respects been true. The U.S. has led the world in economic strength, in technological innovation, and cultural exports. But the past few rocky years have some losing the faith in U.S. primacy. Troop deployments continue, the American economy remains sluggish, and Washington is paralyzed by partisan bickering. So, is the U.S. in decline? One foreign policy expert says don't count out America yet. Today on the program, Michael Haltzel joins us to talk about America's positioning for the future. Plus, how to capture natural beauty in image and word. A conversation with Stephen Trimble. All that and your calls coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Take the slow recovery from the Great Recession, the two lengthy wars in the Middle East, and competition from China and Brazil and India, and you put it all together, and it could be argued that the U.S. is a nation in decline. But foreign policy scholar Michael Haltzel says the U.S. is actually well-positioned for the future, but there are some obstacles. Today on the program, Haltzel joins us to defend his argument that America can succeed in the 21st century. Michael Haltzel is a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. Dr. Haltzel is the author or editor of 10 books on international relations and European history, and he previously served as senior foreign policy advisor to then-Senator Joseph Biden from 1994 to 2005, and Michael Haltzel joins me in studio. Dr. Haltzel, welcome. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer. Pleasure to be here.
Dr. Michael Haltzel will deliver the lecture, Is the U.S. in Decline? Putting the 21st Century in Perspective. That's happening tonight, October 16th at 7 o'clock at Westminster College. We'll give you more details on that as we go. Later on in the program, we turn to the naturalist Stephen Trimble to talk about the land as inspiration for creativity. But first, America in the 21st century. What indicators are you looking at when it comes to America's position in the world? How can the U.S. regain its top standing on the world stage? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Dr. Haltzel, over the past 6 to 9 months, there have been numerous articles in Time and Newsweek and Al Jazeera and the British newspapers all over the world speculating about what sort of trajectory America is on going into the future. Why do we see all this hand-wringing right now?
Well, Jennifer, first of all, it's not new. I went back to look at the whole debate about decline and found that we've been having it for at least 6 decades. I have a juicy quote, which I'm not going to have time to cite tonight, saying we can't afford another decade of decline like this. We just can't afford it. And it was a quote by none other than Henry Kissinger from 1960. So we're talking about a debate, which I think is a healthy one. I mean, you have to stay on top of your game. You have to be self-critical. But this is not new. You're right. There have been all kinds of articles. There have also been books by pretty eminent folks. It's interesting. I know two of the three. I know both of the gentlemen who have written the most popular books. Robert Kagan, whose name I think is familiar to most of our listeners, who of the Mars and Venus category. He wrote a book called The World America Made, and another Robert Lieber from Georgetown wrote a book called Power and Willpower in the American Future. Both, I believe, came out this year. They're both pretty conservative guys, and I think they're defensive. What I'm trying to say is that most people who are commenting on it among the social scientists are pretty defensive and pretty conservative. I guess that's going to put me in the conservative camp, too, because I don't think in most ways we're in decline. But maybe we could talk about it a bit. Let me just also say that with regard to my speech this evening, Utah Council's citizen diplomacy scheduled this several months ago, and the Presidential Commission on Debates somehow overlooked us and didn't consult us about the time. And as you may know, it's exactly the second debate, the town hall between President Obama and Governor Romney, is exactly at the time when I'm going to be starting my talk. So I would only hope that listeners know how to use their TiVos, know how to tape. Took me a while to figure it out, but it's very easy. A couple of clicks on your DVD button, and you can save it and still come to my talk. I am really looking forward to some good Q&A, especially at the end.
Well, okay, you've got your competition tonight, but give us a little preview of what you're going to be talking about. I mean, are you Pollyannish about this?
No, I don't think I am. I'll try to give you an overview without essentially scooping myself. I'm a historian, and I think you really can't even begin to figure out where you are, let alone where you're going, until you look at where you've come from. And I begin by talking about what I see as four mega trends over the last half century, specific to American society. One of them is so obvious that we often forget it, and that's the enormous growth in our population. I mean, I'm going to date myself now, but when I was a senior in high school, we had 175 million people. We now have 313 million. That alone is just astonishing. It puts a strain on the infrastructure, but I think on balance, it's a good thing. We have and I'm going to talk about this a little bit too, a healthy demographic profile in contrast to all of our major competitors, with the possible exception of India. Europe has negative birth rates, and they're not terribly good at integrating immigrants, which I'm going to be talking about also. Even China promises to become the first major country in the world to grow old before it becomes wealthy. I mentioned Europe. Germany, which is doing very, very well, it's the country that I know best other than my own. By 2050, its working age population will have declined by a third. We have a slight natural increase in population fertility, and it's augmented by immigrants. So we have a healthy demographic profile. There are some people who know a whole lot more about economics and certainly about demography than I do, who believe that this in itself is a gigantic advantage. But that brings me to the second mega trend specific to American society, and I'm rather passionate about this one, and that is the successful integration of tens of millions of newcomers into American society. And this is an accomplishment that this should not be underestimated. I've had the good fortune to live and study and work in Europe. And I can tell you, we are unusual, maybe unique in this respect. And a lot of my original scholarly work on Russian history and continuing on has led me to believe that the receptivity of the host culture is the single most important variable. And, you know, the United States, a big place, 313 million people, a continent. You can basically extract a quote here and there and prove anything. But I think on balance, we're a very welcoming society. We do have some xenophobes, but I think they're in a small minority. Real quickly, I'll give you my next two mega trends. One is so obvious, the successful struggle for legal and social equality for all Americans. Until recently, I would have said that the two most, I would say the two largest groups of beneficiaries are women of all races and African Americans of both sexes. And I could talk a little bit about my own very, very small involvement in that movement. And so the first three mega trends are very positive. Now I'm going to give you a negative one. And this is, I'm sure, going to stir some debate this evening, and I certainly hope it does. That's the galloping increase in income and wealth inequality in our country. It's really, really, I think, a terrible thing. And just to cite one statistic, from the end of World War II until 1973, the productivity of American workers increased by 96%. That in itself is impressive. Their average annual, their average hourly compensation increased by 94%. That is to say, it was an equitable sharing of prosperity. Their labor was compensated almost exactly to the percentage that their productivity increased. From 1973 to 2011, productivity increased by another 80%. It's good news. It's hard to increase by almost as much percent when the denominator is big. I mean, it gets increasingly difficult to keep up that rate. Nonetheless, we essentially did it. 80% hourly compensation rose by only 10%. We can talk about the policies that were largely to, I won't say to blame, but that largely made this possible. But I think, and I can talk about all sorts of statistics, life expectancy, educational hunger in America, absolutely shocking statistics. And these aren't pulled out of the blue. These are official statistics. So where does this leave us? Is there a short answer to the question, is the United States in decline? If I had to give a short answer, I would give a variant on a common one. And that is no but, not yes but, no but. Now, I don't think we're in decline, and I can talk a little bit about where we stand frozen in time right now in comparison to our competitors. And then I go on to look at the future, citing a national intelligence study, which is essentially unclassified and will come out in a few weeks. But I've talked in a soliloquy for too long, Jennifer. Why don't you ask me another question?
Well, I mean, as a historian, maybe you can put this into some broader context. What exactly gives a nation its power? You've talked about several indicators, including a growing, vibrant population, social equality measures. But, I mean, just in the abstract, what makes America powerful? What makes other nations powerful?
Right. Well, I think that's a key question. And the first one most people turn to is GDP, gross domestic product. Well, ours has never been higher. What about GDP, our GDP as a percentage of global GDP? Well, shortly after World War II, which ruined Europe and large parts of Asia, we accounted for more than half of the global GDP. That obviously was an aberration. Today, United States comprises about a quarter of nominal GDP, about 20% of global GDP at purchasing power parity, so about 20%, and about 20% of global manufacturing output. People forget we're still a huge manufacturing country. So, I mean, I think the decline relative to other countries is a matter of the rise of the rest. What are some other indices? Well, we're still first in the world in spending on research and development. We're first in on various indices of entrepreneurship. Where we've fallen down a bit, I have to say, is competitiveness. How competitive is the economy? We were first only about 4 or 5 years ago. Now, according to the World Economic Forum, we've fallen to seventh. Behind Switzerland, Singapore, Finland, Sweden, the Netherlands, and Germany, largely because of our political conflicts and growing debt, and I'll talk about that at some length this evening. China, though, is only 29th. What about other metrics? Well, U.S. military, talk about strength, obviously we're second to none. We have an overwhelming quantitative and qualitative superiority over all our potential enemies. Our defense budget is larger than the next 10 countries, friend and foe combined. Yes, there are dangers from what they call asymmetrical warfare, terrorism, cyber attacks. But I think that compared to the challenges that our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents faced, they're really not in the same league. I'm not worried about the military. Education. We got a problem with elementary and secondary education. Everybody knows that. We have to upgrade our capabilities. some of the international comparisons are apples and oranges. We can go into that if you'd like, but I'm still not satisfied. When you get to higher education, it looks a whole lot better. By just about every study, we have the vast majority of the world's best research universities, and then we have a uniquely American jewel, I can call it, of small liberal arts colleges like Westminster, where I'll be giving my talk this evening. So we're doing pretty well then. One serious problem with higher education, though, is it's becoming increasingly difficult to access. That's largely because of this income inequality exacerbated by the recession. And I cite some statistics that I think will surprise people. And then finally, scientific prowess. Well, we're second to none. I mean, I get goosebumps even thinking about it. If you read the newspapers as recently as this morning, you'll see we continue to have a wide lead in Nobel Prizes. Our engineers are second to none. The Mars rover Curiosity is, for my money, about the most amazing, incomprehensible technological feat that I've ever seen. It just blows your mind when you look at the detail, and that's American. Or even just the infrastructure of our daily lives, your iPhones, your Androids, the internet, these are all things we created. So I think we're doing well. The very final thing, though, is the hardest, and here probably I will occasion a lot of debate, although I don't go into it deeply, and that, to some extent, I think, although society can be measured by material achievements, I think the character of society is arguably even more important. And here they're hot-button issues, and I know that people of goodwill from different religions, from different parts of the country, can have different views. One person's long overdue progress is another symptom of moral decay, whether it's gay marriage to abortion to gun controls, you name it. I do think that there are a few sociological trends that everybody can agree on, though. And here we're doing pretty well. I mean, the divorce rate in this country it peaked in 1979. It's been in major decline ever since. There's kind of an urban myth out there that 50% of marriages in America end in divorce. Not true. Teen pregnancies across all ethnicities are at an all-time low. Serious crime in the United States has declined significantly. We still have a huge incarcerated population. But I think these are things that, even if we can't agree on the hot-button issues, I think these are sociological things we can't agree upon.
Mm. We're talking about America's standing in the world and how the country can reinforce its central role and its leadership on the world stage. With me in studio, Dr. Michael Haltzell. He's a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins University. He'll deliver the lecture, "Is the U.S. in Decline? Putting the 21st Century in Perspective." That's happening tonight, Tuesday, October 16th at 7 o'clock. The lecture is free and open to the public and will be held in the Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College, 1840 South, 1300 East in Salt Lake City. It's part of the World Affairs Lecture Series sponsored by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy. And we invite you to join our conversation this morning. Do you think the U.S. is in decline, or do you share Michael Haltzell's assessment that America can remain a superpower for the foreseeable future? You can join us. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier Pierce. There's been a lot of hand-wringing that the U.S. is slipping. Here at home, we've got a slow economy, there's political paralysis in Washington, and two wars overseas to contend with. Meanwhile, the middle class, the economy, and innovation is growing in places like Brazil and China. So this begs the question, is the U.S. in decline? And to that, foreign policy expert Michael Haltzell says not yet. He is delivering the lecture, "Is the U.S. in Decline? Putting the 21st Century in Perspective," tonight. That's Tuesday, October 16th at 7 o'clock at Westminster College. And he's here in studio with us to talk about the issue. You can join our conversation as well. What do you think should be done to bolster America's standing in world affairs? give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. Dr. Holtzel, I mean, I guess, what about Iraq and Afghanistan? We've spent a trillion dollars, over $1 trillion on these two wars. We've lost, I think it's over 6,000 soldiers at this point. Yeah. How can the nation retain its place as a superpower when it's stretched militarily?
Well, number one, I don't think we're necessarily stretched militarily. We have fantastic military.
We do, but we have soldiers who have been on 3 and 4 deployments.
That
and
is true.
Tough.
That is absolutely true. And look, you have to make resources available, and you don't put it on the credit card. And if you're talking about overall strength, earlier in the program I talked about GDP. I could have talked about other economic indices. We had a budget surplus not too long ago, 2001. There are any number of reasons why it changed, tax cuts, but especially putting two wars on the credit card. This is awful. But back to your question, should we be in these places? My own feeling was Iraq. No, I think it was a war of choice, and I think we found out that the reasoning behind it was fallacious. Afghanistan, yes. They allowed al-Qaeda to brew September 11th. We had every right to go in. And the problem with Afghanistan, it seems to me, is that we withdrew key assets to fight the war in Iraq. I'm talking about intelligence assets, especially linguistic, which are terribly important in waging counterinsurgencies. So it's a problem. We're getting out of Iraq. Essentially, we are out of Iraq, except for some advisors. We're going to get out of Afghanistan in 2014. I think in the future, we're going to have to think long and hard about commitments abroad, just how central they are to U.S. interests. I think Syria is a good example. There are people who believe that we should be intervening more on the ground. I think that would be a mistake. Libya, it seems to me, was an example of, however halting at the beginning, it wound up going well. And for a change, we were not we were the lead country in the sense that without our suppression of anti-aircraft assets and without our intel, it couldn't have worked. But the fact is we had allied countries and even some that weren't allied flying sorties. When I say not allied, but good friends, I'm thinking Sweden in this case. And it worked. And the world is a complex place. I'm not making the argument that there's a template for this. Syria is not Libya. It's a different country. It's more densely populated. There would be huge civilian casualties. They have a much, much, much stronger military than Gaddafi did. So even here, within the space of a year, we have two examples that are very different. But I do think we have to be very, very careful about what we do. I think in this country, quite often, politicians like to badmouth alliances. They certainly badmouth the international order. But there are, we've gained a huge amount from international organizations, be it the UN or international treaties like the Convention on Conventional Forces in Europe or the various strategic agreements with Russia. We've gained from this. And I frankly think with regard to Iran, the sanctions, which have taken long and hard negotiations, and you can always criticize coulda, woulda, shoulda, or say that Russia gave a veto over what we did, which is just a perversion of the idea of negotiations. The fact is the sanctions on Iran are really biting. Do I have absolute confidence that it's going to put an end to their nuclear program? No, I don't have confidence for sure, but I think it's hurting. Anyway, it's a tough question. It's a complex world. We inherited a really, really serious degradation of American power. Incidentally, our standing with our allies has gone up. I mean, that's not my opinion. We're talking about very sophisticated public opinion polls in Europe. Here I'm talking about Europe. 30 points higher than what it was in 2008. There, in the Islamic world, it is true. It's still very low, higher than it was before. That's maybe not saying very much. But this does matter. We wouldn't be able to get countries to cooperate with us, be it on sanctions or on air wars like Libya, if they didn't have more confidence in the United States.
Speaking with Dr. Michael Holtzel, a senior fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins University. He's delivering the lecture, Is the U.S. in Decline? And that's the subject of our conversation this morning, if you'd like to join us. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Benny, a caller from Salt Lake City, called in, couldn't stay on the line, but says we're slipping in education and thinks that that should be the number one issue. I mean, the backbone of economic strength has traditionally been investments in education and in young people. And today, the U.S. spends, $4 to every $1 they spend on young people, $4 for seniors to every $1 they spend for, you know, people under 18. So, I mean, I guess Benny's question is a good one. Are we making the sorts of investments in education and in scientific research that will pay dividends in the future?
Well, I agree. I think Benny gave posed a very good question. I had said in the first part of our interview this morning that elementary and secondary education are a real challenge. The whole question of national standards versus state standards versus local standards is a tough one. Years ago, I was vice president for academic affairs of one of the state universities in Virginia, and I know that question of standards, question of merit pay for teachers or professors, these are hugely divisive issues. The question of spending is an interesting one. I live in the Washington, D.C. area. I'm in Virginia, but I live in the Washington, D.C. area. Washington, D.C. spends more per pupil than any other place in the country, or than any other if it were a state. The highest outlay, and yet the results are pretty meager. Improving slightly under the former chancellor, Michelle Rhee, who is no longer chancellor. But it's not just a question of money. Obviously, we put a huge burden on the schools to solve problems in society that society is not solving, whether it's poverty or crime or broken families. One really important variable in a pupil's achievement is the family background. Is it a one parent family? Is the family bread earner, not earning bread? Do you live in a slum? I think the American kids who rise out of situations like the ones I just described really not only deserve credit, but they deserve a boost in college admissions. I mean, I think they are starting at such a disadvantage. One last word about standardized scores. It's absolutely true we're not doing as well as we should. And I heard this morning on the news that your governor said he hoped to get 66% of people up to standard by the end of his, something like the end of his term. And that's great. I wish it were 100%. When, however, you make international comparisons, you have to be very, very careful. We are pretty much unique among countries in that the overwhelming majority of our elementary and secondary schools are comprehensive schools. That is to say, people children from all kinds of backgrounds, many of whom will go to college, many of whom won't, are thrown together. Because ever since the colonial days, ever since the first years of our republic, the major task of American education is to educate for a democracy. In Europe and East Asia, there's streaming going on. Kids take these tests in eighth grade, which essentially determine their lives. I mean, I have three grandsons in Germany who are dual citizens, German and American. And you know, I promise you, how they do on these tests is key. Yes, there are end runs you can make. You can make up for ground, but that's a tiny percentage. So you have to be sure that on the standardized test, you're not comparing kids who go to high-power gymnasium in Germany or lycée in France with kids from a suburban high school in Utah that has kids from all across the socioeconomic spectrum. When you do have somewhat similar, and again, I can't quote you because I didn't write these down, but several years ago, they had an article on this in our area, and again, we're very proud of our public schools in Fairfax County, Virginia. Some of the Maryland suburbs of Washington, Montgomery County have excellent schools. When you compare the kids in those schools who come from the overwhelmingly college prep kids, they actually do pretty well compared to the international competition. So that's an apples and apples, not an apples and oranges. I'm not making excuses in any way, shape, or form. Benny is absolutely right. We have to upgrade our elementary and secondary, and we have to make higher education, in which we still lead the world, we have to make it more accessible to all our kids.
Benny, thanks so much for the call. Let's go to Eloise, who's holding in Salt Lake City. Eloise, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to ask if you'd speak a little bit more about the contributing factors to our current economic wage disparities, the haves and the have-nots, and the inherent dangers to our country because of it.
That's a good question, Eloise. Thanks for the call. I mean, this wealth gap, the gap between rich and poor, is widening, not only here in America, but in other developed countries. So, I mean, how is that a factor when we talk about a country, a superpower? How does that factor in?
Factors in a huge way, and Eloise is exactly right. I mean, the income disparities are bad, and I think there have been some recent articles that I would cite to you. There's one in Foreign Affairs, just so you know, I'm a scholar and I cite my sources. there's an article in the current issue of Foreign Affairs by a scholar named Andrea Louise Campbell, who's a professor at MIT. And it's called America the Undertaxed. Boy, if that doesn't get people out there in your area exercise, nothing will. U.S. Fiscal Policy and Perspective. Let me quote a few things. First of all, Professor Campbell's major thesis is, compared with other developed countries, the United States has very low taxes, little redistribution of income, and the third, everybody knows, an extraordinarily complex tax code.
Well, our time is short, but to Eloise, I mean, how does it, if the wage gap, the wealth gap continues to widen, I mean, what effect will that have on U.S. standing as a superpower? I mean, will it have an enormous effect?
Of course, absolutely. It'll have a huge effect, and it's starting to already. We often mock Great Britain as being, prototypical society of the hereditary rich and not having social mobility. Well, guess what? The odds of a kid whose parents didn't go to college going to college in the UK now are much, much higher than they are in the United States. I mean, that's just ridiculous. But there we are, and as I said, we can. See the economic performance is directly tied to economic knowledge. I mean, if we don't have engineers, I lauded our engineers who created the Mars rover, Curiosity, and other things. If we don't continue to educate people to fill their shoes, then we will be on a glide path. But let me just say just one last thing, and I'm going to have to cite this. You hear a lot of talk about how we're overtaxed. Well, guess what? We're not, by any standard. Total tax revenues as a percentage of GDP in the industrialized world. Now, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, this is the 34 highly industrialized countries in the world, and they have very, very sophisticated economists who can measure federal, state, local consumption taxes, VAT, and everything. You'll be happy to know that only two of the other 33 countries in the OECD have lower tax rates than we do, of that is to say tax revenues as a percentage of GDP. The only two that are lower are Chile, and the lowest is Mexico. And guess what? The countries that are ahead of us in that competitiveness survey that I mentioned are all way above us. Sweden, which was fourth in competitiveness, has the second highest tax revenues as a percentage of GDP. Finland, which was third in competitiveness, is almost as high. Netherlands, Germany, Switzerland is the most competitive, has a significantly higher tax burden than we do. Just, we are not a heavily taxed country. Even corporate taxes. Raw corporate taxes are very high, 39%. But by the time you factor in all the special tax breaks, guess what? It goes down to 13%. So when you take the effective corporate tax rate, we're actually low. Not as low as we are overall, but still very low.
Eloise, thanks for the call. Our time is very short, but I want to sneak in Sam from Salt Lake City. Sam, hi.
Hi. My call is just about, I've read that India and China, before the colonial imperial period, were a third of world trade or more. And I wanted to know if you thought that we were emerging from that time, that they would become stage, and what do you think the United States should do about that?
Okay, I'm not sure I caught the.
Sam, can you repeat the last part? Yeah, your phone was breaking up.
Sorry. I wanted to know if the guest thinks that we're emerging colonial imperial period, where coming back to the way the world used to be in the 1600s, where China and India were much larger players.
Yeah.
Okay, Sam, thanks for the call. Dr. Holtzel, very quickly.
Excellent question. Well, there's no doubt that it wasn't until the 17th century that India and China started to decline. And you're right, the colonial period really sapped them, and there's a huge resentment. Are we returning to that situation? I would say not exactly. Certainly, India and China are on the rise, but I don't think we're going to see a situation where India and China will dominate the world the way the United States essentially has for the last 50 years. They're certainly on the way up. They have their own vulnerabilities, but I think we have certain strengths that no other country has. And to hear them, I would advise you to come tonight, 7 o'clock.
There you go.
7 o'clock to my talk.
I'll give you the details in just a second. About a minute left.
Sure.
What's it going to take to keep America on
top? What it's going to take is compromise in Washington. That's the Achilles heel. And I spent 11 years working in the U.S. Senate, and I can tell you there is gridlock, and we have some people who have become stereotypical European ideologically driven. You cannot have our system of checks and balances, separation of power, has worked brilliantly for most of our 2.25 centuries, but it is absolutely predicated upon compromise. And again, I'm going to talk in some detail tonight about this. Right now, we're not compromising, and it's ridiculous.
Dr. Michael Holtzel, he is Senior Fellow at the Center for Transatlantic Relations at Johns Hopkins University's School of Advanced International Studies. He will deliver the lecture, Is the U.S. in Decline? Putting the 21st Century in Perspective, tonight, Tuesday, October 16th at 7 o'clock. The lecture is free and open to the public. It will be held in the Gore Concert Hall at Westminster College here in Salt Lake City. It's part of the World Affairs Lecture Series sponsored by the Utah Council for Citizen Diplomacy. And Dr. Holtzel, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Coming up next, Stephen Trimble on nature and the creative spark. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Notepads and cameras in hand, a group of Utahns recently visited Montana's Centennial Valley to explore and to be inspired by one of America's greatest wildlife refuges. A new exhibit of their work opens this weekend, and today on the program, their instructor, the naturalist Stephen Trimble, joins us to describe their creative field trip. And Stephen, great to have you here. Thanks so much for your time.
I'm always pleased to be here, Jennifer.
Stephen Trimble is an acclaimed naturalist, writer, and photographer with more than 20 published books to his name. He was a Wallace Stegner Centennial Fellow at the University of Utah's Tanner Humanities Center, and he's received many awards, including the Sierra Club's Ansel Adams Award. And the exhibit, Tutored by the Land, an exhibition of photography and writing from Centennial Valley, opens this Friday, October 19th at 6 o'clock at Art Space. We'll give you more details on that as we go. But if you'd like to join our conversation, how does nature, the mountains or the changing leaves or wildlife, inspire you? Let us know if your retreats to the mountains or to the desert have led to writing or painting or photography. You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. For those who are not familiar with the Centennial Valley in Montana, describe this setting, the setting for this class for us. Stephen Trimble.
Sure. If you drive north on I-15 up through Idaho, you cross into Montana over Moneta Pass. And right at the top of the pass, at exit zero, if you turn right, you end up in this big, gorgeous, remote valley, the Centennial Valley, that's really the first valley north into Montana, just on the backside of the Centennial Mountains. And that valley holds Red Rock Lakes National Wildlife Refuge that you mentioned, often described as the most beautiful national wildlife refuge in the country, set aside decades ago primarily for the trumpeter swan, which was right on the edge of extinction. And so you have this valley that almost feels like a Great Basin Valley with wetlands surrounded by mountain ranges, part of the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So there are grizzlies in the mountains and wolves that, at night, if you get really, really lucky. And in the early days, the railroad went over Moneta Pass, and a sagecoach route took out over Centennial Valley to take people to Yellowstone. That was the main access point for Yellowstone National Park in the early days. And an old stage station in Lakeview, Montana, is a ghost town now. And a very wonderful local family, John and Melody Taft, basically bought the old ghost town and restored it to be the Environmental Humanities Education Center that the University of Utah Humanities Program now has a relationship with. So our Go Learn session, our group of students that went up to spend this weekend thinking about how do we react to this place in some sort of creative way, stayed at the Environmental Humanities Education Center, which is essentially now University of Utah Field Station, with programs and possibilities for taking coursework there in these just delightful little cabins and restored buildings.
So this was basically an outing of a class of students from the University of Utah. What were the goals of your students, and how did that match up with your goals as the instructor?
Interesting question. We had about 9 students, and we had a couple of other folks that sat in on the class, and that was a wonderful group of interested, receptive, talented, creative folks that ranged from an undergraduate up to retired people with a lot of camera equipment. And our goal was really to think about how do we respond creatively to landscape. And obviously my two primary skills are photography and writing, but we talked about illustrated journals, drawing in your journals. We talked with Hal Cannon in a day of prep before we went up to Montana about thinking about interviews and audio and video and the people in that landscape. So we tried to be pretty broad in our approach, and my goal was simply to open up people to ways of thinking about landscape that they hadn't thought about before. You know, if they were photographers, I wanted them to think a little bit about journaling and trying to get their ideas and emotions and responses to the land down in their journals in words. And if they were primarily writers, I wanted them to look around and think visually. And for all of us who were not interested or experienced in video or audio, to think about sound and motion. You know, there's so many different ways to open yourself up to these amazing places in the West that we visit.
Mm. You're a photographer, a writer. I mean, why do you continue to turn to the natural environment for inspiration? I mean, you can find inspiration anywhere. What is it about the mountains or the water or the wildlife that speaks to you?
Oh, my, Jennifer, that would require kind of telling you about my entire career, I think.
3 minutes.
That's right. Well, I think we have a fundamental connection with the natural world. You know, lots of brilliant philosophers have talked about this, people like E.O. Wilson and his concept of biophilia. And without our connection to the natural world, I think we become less than human, less than who we can be. And we need those connections to be fully alive. And our visits back to wild country, whether that's Liberty Park or 150 miles out into the West Desert or Centennial Valley, remind us of where humans came from and the fundamental connections we have to all the other species and the land that gives us life, you know, water and grass that feeds grazing animals and all of the plants and animals that have sustained people who have lived in the American West for 12,000 years. Mm.
Speaking with Stephen Trimble, the photographer, the writer, also the instructor of a class that went to the Centennial Valley in Montana. And the result is an exhibit coming up, Tutored by the Land, an exhibition of photography and writing from Centennial Valley. It opens this Friday, October 19th. At Art Space in the Heal, Utah offices. We'll give you details on that as we go. Stephen Trimble, I want to talk about a few of the images that will be on display this weekend. The first one is from Jim Dowling. He has a beautiful image of a black and white bird. I wish I knew what it was, but it's perched so happily in this pine tree. He's got another of a doe that's leaning down for a drink beside a meandering river. I mean, what are the secrets to capturing wildlife images? Because those seem to be really tricky.
It's clearly patience. I mean, there's a matter of luck as well, but I talk about putting yourself in the path of opportunity, in the path of luck. You know, spend a lot of time out there and keep your eyes open and pay attention. And it's amazing what you see. You know, the Centennial Valley is alive with wildlife. We saw moose and coyote and fox and many, many different kinds of birds. And Jim's one of those older photographers who's passionate about bird photography, spends a lot of time out there, sort of semi-retired, and takes wonderful pictures. You know, there's a lot of variety in this exhibit from people like Jim and a couple of other folks who are primarily interested in photographing birds to people who love landscape and look for, you know, the big views and the sunsets and the details to folks who got really excited about the old historic ranches that are in the valley. There's some incredible ruined barns just down the road from the center, and several of our groups of students went out there to spend time. So the exhibit that we'll have in the little Art Space Commons gallery will include a lot of variety. We'll have a slideshow that will have lots of pictures, plus a fair number of framed pictures and quite a bit of variety.
There are a few of the images that I saw that really focus on this transition between night and day, that twilight or the dawn. And I guess, you know, Montana's known for its big skies. They're very, very dramatic. Can you just briefly describe how you use light or how photographers can use light to their advantage in capturing sort of this bigness?
Absolutely. I mean, we're always chasing light. Photographers chase light. When I interviewed photographers for my book on Grand Canyon photography, Lasting Light, I realized that the photographers were talking about light as if it was something alive. And I ended up talking about the psychology of light. It's trickster light, too. You know, it's very fleeting. You have to be there and catch it, and then it's gone. And
Can't hesitate.
No, you can't hesitate. You have to be set up and ready to catch it, or just be very, very good at setting up very quickly and catch it before it's gone. We actually had a couple of very smoky days from fires that gave us great sunrises and sunsets, but, you know, dark gray, sort of muddy skies during the day. And my advice to photographers is always let the sky determine where the top of your picture is. You know, if there's nothing going on in the sky, virtually eliminate the sky from your composition. If the sky is filled with gorgeous clouds, use those. And so that's exactly what we did. So we were out at the magic hour early in the morning. We tried to schedule our cocktail hour and dinner so that we wouldn't miss the magic hour at the end of the day. And then we had people going out after dark taking gorgeous pictures of stars over the fire tower right there at the center.
That sounds like a wonderful excursion. Stephen Trimble is a writer and photographer. He led a group exploring the Centennial Valley in Montana, and the result is the exhibit Tutored by the Land, which opens Friday, October 19th at ArtSpace, 824 South, 400 West. And there's more detail on our website, kcpw.org. For City Views, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.